Today It Is. I am Matt.
And I am Richard.
And we discuss things in the entertainment industry that capture our interest. Talking about movies, TVs, that's smart. DVDs, video games, and I've got a cold, so that's going on.
And I can talk about TVs today. I had a weird little experience or something that occurred to me. So we can talk about TVs today.
That's great. I actually saw a movie in the theater last week. Quite exciting. We went and saw The Social Network.
Oh, yeah?
The Facebook movie. It was exactly what I expected. It was very well done, and my expectations were high, and it met them.
Cool.
It was really enjoyable. Really, the only downside about it was we saw it at the Woodinville Theater, which is the closest to us.
Yep.
And I swear the bulb was flickering. It really seemed like, you know, some of the shots where there would be a really light background, you could see it flickering. It could have been an optical illusion, but because Jeff Wells has been bitching about AMC for the past couple of weeks, it kind of stuck in my head as, oh, we're at an AMC theater. So clearly they are milking everything they can out of their bulbs.
Yeah.
Anyway, but the movie itself was great. You know, all the reviews are accurate. Aaron Sorkin's dialogue is fantastic. David Fincher does a great job. Jesse Eisenberg is fantastic.
Justin Timberlake.
Yeah, also fantastic.
Yeah.
It's a really well done movie, and it's one of those, I honestly don't know if I would have nailed it as a Fincher film.
Really?
I probably wouldn't have, honestly. But there's a few things, like when you hear, for example, that this pair of twins, the Winklevoss twins, or the Winklevi.
Yeah.
It's two different guys as a body double, and they took one of the actors, and put his face on the other one digitally.
Yeah, I heard that.
And it was flawless. I could not detect any bit of, you know, rotoscoping green screen work that looked sloppy. It was, I mean, even knowing it was digital, I absolutely could not tell.
Yeah.
And you know, he's done a lot of work with digital backgrounds, and I think it's a lot easier, in my opinion, to get away with digital backgrounds. It's more work, but he puts in the work. I think it's a lot harder with stuff like face mapping and have it look natural.
Well, he absolutely he fills his movies with it, and he clearly tries to do it in a way that you're not realizing it's digital. And even like the in Zodiac, there like in that opening scene where the Donovan Hurdy-Gurdy Man song is playing, and you realize all of these little things, like just like brief shots of like a guy getting shot in the face and blood going, or all of this digitally created. There was no blood anywhere in this in the thing. It was all added, and it doesn't even occur to you, oh, that was digital, you know. And that's, I think he's one of the few directors that loves massively using a lot of digital and hates the idea that in any way you could tell it was digital, which Zodiac was a case in point, because when it was over, nothing really particularly occurred to me it was digital. And then watching the effects reel, you realize, my God, 30% of this movie had some form of digital shot in there. And The Social Network strikes me, just you bringing that up, and I'd forgotten about those twins. Wouldn't have even occurred to you that there would have been any kind of digital work done in that. But him, he's probably thinking, well, I could look around for a couple twin actors, but why when I can do a better job this way with digital? I mean, he's a pretty remarkable director.
Yeah, he definitely is. But it's a great movie, and it really does. It tells an interesting story. A couple of the criticisms I was trying to keep in mind, you know, how do you make coding look interesting?
Yeah.
And really, the only coding part was sort of at the beginning of the film, after he's pissed at his girlfriend. And there's not that much of it. So that was pretty interesting. The criticism that there really weren't any strong female characters. I get that, but it's like, what do you do if there weren't any involved in the story?
Yeah.
You know, are you supposed, you know, same, and to pull it in a completely different direction, you look at Lord of the Rings, and there was the criticism of there were no female characters in Lord of the Rings. And I was just reading that they have the same problem with The Hobbit. there's really no female characters in The Hobbit. What do you do? Well, Lord of the Rings, they beefed up this Liv Tyler Eowyn character from the appendices and sort of inserted her as a storyline, which I think worked pretty well, even though, well, that's okay. But in the, you know, I don't know what they're going to do with The Hobbit, but it's like, what do you do? There were no females in the story. I, you know.
Now, did when everything's said and done, did Zuckerberg come off completely as a monster, or did he kind of come across as, well, yeah, he was this kind of jerky thing, but he's also clearly comes off as a genius, or was it somewhere in between, or what?
Well, definitely in between. I mean, he made some jackass moves, but you can tell he also has this, part of it was, it's implied that he sort of fell under the spell of Sean Parker.
Yeah.
Who he idolized, the creator of Napster.
This is the
The Timberlake character.
Yeah, but I thought Sean Fanning created Napster. Was this like his partner? Or
maybe I don't think they changed names.
No, I don't know. They didn't change names. It's two different people, but I had never even heard of this Parker. Fanning is the one that was the Napster guy, but I think Parker was his partner or something.
That has never gotten into, and Napster is so far removed that I don't remember.
Well, because Fanning, you know, I remember in the early 2000s, after it had completely imploded, he was actually in some movies and something as himself, you know, because he was sort of famous for a few minutes there. But I think Parker was the guy that made out like a bank from it. So anyway,
yeah, he doesn't come across, you know, you can certainly, if you choose to, you can read it as a, as he's a monster. But, you know, I think they did a good job of putting that moral ambiguity in there of, you know, he definitely did some jackass things, but not everything. You know, it's not like he was, I don't know. I really enjoyed it. I will definitely be watching it again on Netflix.
Yeah.
So that was our big movie theater experience.
Sweet.
Have you seen anything in the theater in the past 2 weeks?
Jackass 3D.
Suck. And, you know.
Go ahead.
I know you think I hate those films or hate that whole concept. It's not that I hate it. It's just not for me.
That's what I mean. I'm not saying you... I don't mean you hate it. I mean that you are... You would be... you would not enjoy it. Sort of the opposite.
Probably
of it.
Not. Although, I'm a little more sympathetic because, you know, Johnny Knoxville went on The Daily Show a couple weeks ago and was pimping it. And he was very upfront and very, you know, I can't believe I get to do this garbage and film it and people pay to see it.
Well, the meme for promoting this one... Is that you know publicists come up with here's how we're gonna pitch this and get it out there, and the meme this year was, well, you know, this is really goofy and these guys are the modern variants of Buster Keaton, Charlie Chaplin, stuff that everybody seemed to now sort of respect but wasn't considered there, so they had this highly publicized, we're gonna have a premiere at the Museum of Modern Art in this guise of it's this modern version of this, and I actually completely agree with them, but it's just funny, that's the whole meme from it. But the fact is, you know, he didn't talk about it in any of these interviews, but Knoxville has been on Howard Stern a couple times, and he's talked about the fact that he had a injury to his Johnson and severe. This is about 4 years ago on one of these things, to the point that he has to have this, he has to self-insert a catheter every day, three times a day to go to the bathroom in this thing. And he was doing this every day and he's going, now I'm hopefully when I'm done, I'll have protected this so they don't have to do surgery to essentially render my ability to go to the bathroom easily unavailable. So I have to do this for a year. And then hopefully it will have healed or whatever. Well, it turns out it didn't heal. So for the rest of his life, Johnny Knoxville, every single day is shoving something up his Johnson. If you can imagine how horrible that is. He does that every day from these stupid movies. So when you think about that and realize, yeah, the what they're doing on these movies is just horrendous to themselves. It puts it in different perspective. That said, it was uproariously funny. And if you can handle scatological stuff and other stuff, it's fantastically funny. And I couldn't help but think, wow, I can't believe I'm sitting here in the Cinnabar eating dinner, watching people getting covered with dog feces and puke and vomit. It was incredible.
Well done.
We were, you know, the audience was just laughing like crazy. My dad was laughing like crazy. You know, people were laughing. It's that visceral, unbelievably crazy, stupid laugh that is at the most base level. And I enjoyed it. And of the three movies, I liked this the best. It was definitely one of the best uses of 3D because it wasn't overt at all. And I come to realize that for me, 3D works really well if I'm absolutely in the very back of the theater. Anywhere else, it gives me a headache. But the back of the theater, you can just sort of sit there and take it all in. Also, they clearly used an incredibly expensive high-speed 3D cameras for this because a lot of the images were super slow-mo Mythbusters style, but in 3D, which was really kind of cool to watch some guy's face get totally distorted from the 3D, but in slow motion. So pretty cool. Anyway, I recommend it for people that like that kind of thing.
All right. what was your big TV?
Well, it wasn't a big TV. It was just occurring to me. I was talking to this guy today and I was telling him, or a couple yesterday, I was telling him how, you know, I sold my original original Mac SE for like $400 in the like mid 90s. And in retrospect, I've always wished, God, that thing was so small and so cute, and you could never use it, but I kind of wish I still had it around. It'd be kind of fun to put in my spare bedroom, just sitting there on the desk as like a little reminder of the past that is so anachronistic kind of thing. But in the mid-90s, literally, the only thing you wanted to do was just get rid of something like that. And TVs are the same because I was driving around in my neighborhood and some guy had out in their street this clearly very new, very well taken care of, like 32-inch big TV that he probably paid $500 for. Looked perfect. Had it sitting out free. Works great. And I was thinking, man, now a TV like that, it is such an albatross for people. All they can do is think about, how do I get rid of this? Do I have to pay for it to dump it? And they can't get rid of it. And I'm thinking, boy, if that guy were to somehow hang on to that TV for 10 years from now, it will be that cool retro thing, sort of, maybe. I don't know. You know how stuff like that for a while, you just, it's everything you want to do to get rid of, but 10 years later, it becomes that kind of cool thing. Maybe not a TV because they're so big, but I just couldn't help but thinking how cool that thing's going to look in about 10 years when nobody hardly remembers what a picture tube TV looks like. So, anyway.
Maybe. I get what you're saying. I don't know if that, I definitely don't know if that applies to TVs or computer monitors.
Well, maybe because they're so big, but it will be, I mean, there will be a time when even now you can look at like an old, like a TV from the 60s when everyone saw our 70s, when they would do some of those early Sonys where they had that interesting plastic white cases and stuff. And you'll see that retro look quite a bit, but you're right. You know, keeping them in your house is a different deal. But man, if I had my Mac SE, I'd love to have that sitting on my sitting in my spare bedroom, just kind of for fun, almost as furniture. And it'd be funny just to turn it up and just see how slow it is. Because every time I've used like an older computer, I'm struck by how amazingly slow it is, and I'm going, God, what happened? Do they need to defrag their hard drive? And I realize, no, this is what we dealt with back then. You just forget how massively slow these computers were. So
yeah.
Anyway,
trying to see what DVDs we've had recently. We watched. I pulled in the National Geographic Megastructures discs. Not that great.
Yeah.
I think two discs, two episodes per disc, and.
Isn't that one of the ones they have online now? Because they have they put so much of their stuff.
Not these ones. And I love the engine, like the Discovery Channel engineering.
Yeah, I love those too.
Building the biggest blobbity blah wherever.
Deepest tunnel. You know, they just finished that tunnel in Switzerland. They just connected them, which is amazing.
But this is this had one on. Let's see. It was like the C5 Galaxy plane. That was pretty good. Building a casino in Atlantic City was not that great.
Yeah, and that one is that's just awful. They sort of mentioned in passing in that documentary like eight people have died. Is that the one where they're building the whole city, the city, the the several casinos inside like this giant block thing?
No, this was like the Boga. I want to say Bogota.
Okay.
No, this it just wasn't that good. And like they had bits about they're talking to some of the people that are being hired, including some of the women hostesses, and it's clear that they're just, you know, they're hired like it's like a Hooters thing. Yeah. They're hired because they got. They're very attractive to look at. They got big boobs.
They're well endowed.
You know, and they're talking with one of the things. They're talking about, oh, to be a hostess here means you have to do this and this. And the interview process was really strict. And you're just like, oh, my God, are you kidding me?
Yeah. They needed 10 different interviews to look at my breasts each time.
Right. And so it just seemed really out of place as a National Geographic documentary. And I'm sure it was, you know, someone went out and filmed this thing on spec and then filmed it to them instead of Discovery Channel or History Channel or whoever.
Yeah.
That's really what it felt like. Really inconsistent. So I liked the C5 Galaxy one. I didn't like the casino one. There was one on the Ekati Diamond Mine up in Alaska. That was okay.
Boy, I haven't seen any of these.
And the fourth one, I'm trying to remember what it was. The port at the Netherlands. That was interesting because it showed,
Rotterdam?
I guess. And it was interesting, but it wasn't anything I haven't seen on like 5 or 6 Discovery Channel specials. And Discovery usually has better specials.
Yeah.
At least for these engineering ones. So they were okay, but overall, so that's it for the DVDs. Just gonna look at my streaming. What have I done streaming wise? Is it all Stargate Atlantis?
I don't know either.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. So I haven't watched anything else streaming.
You haven't finished Stargate Atlantis?
No, I put it on hold. Well, part of me getting a job put that on hold.
Yeah.
And the new TV season started. So I've been doing a pretty good job keeping up with that. Having Fox, like, stop everything for a month for baseball helps you keep caught up.
What did you think of the whole sci-fi basically killing Caprica thing?
Well, that's right, because you emailed me. I don't really care.
Did you ever watch it? Were you even remotely interested in it?
A little bit. I had one of my old supervisors, actually, from a couple of jobs ago, was also a huge Battlestar Galactica fan. And when the pilot came out, I asked her, you know, what'd you think? And she said, eh. And so I was like, okay, not mandatory. So I was going to watch it eventually, but it was absolutely not a mandatory thing for me, and not apparently the ratings were horrid.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a mandatory thing for enough people. And I totally give credit for for Ronald Moore, and I'm not sure how involved he was.
Yeah, that was my question. Was he just sort of signing off on this, or was he actively involved?
Well, he was very involved in the pilot.
Yeah.
But I think Jane Espenson was the showrunner for this. I don't know how involved he was. And he was very, when they were selling the show and filming it, he was very upfront about saying, this is not Battlestar Galactica. This is more of a family drama set somewhat in the future that kind of ties in with some Cylon stuff.
Huh.
So if you're expecting this to be all ships, and it's not the same show. It's not the same tone. And he was very honest about that. And I think people just didn't want to watch the show they made. Yeah. Which I think is entirely fair.
Well, you know what? What's funny is, I don't know if it was the article I sent you, but somebody was like quoting it. And it was so funny because they were saying it verbally, but when it was written out, it had this unintended irony. The guy was saying, this is just crazy. That network, it's like all wrestling and this and that. It's called sci-fi, for God's sakes. Why aren't there any of these kinds of shows? But when they spelled it out, it was, it's all S-Y-F-I, for God's sakes. Oh, nice. Meaning, it answered his point, which was that it's not about sci-fi. It's about some quasi-marketing thing that has nothing to do with science fiction. So, anyway. Yeah, I know. I've still not gotten around to seeing Battlestar Galactica, but it struck me as interesting that that even on a show with, or a network with much diminished expectations, it really apparently didn't deliver at all. So, and I thought it was interesting that they literally just massively yanked it. It wasn't even, we're going to let it play out its run. It, they were saying, nope, we're just pulling the plug completely, which was kind of amazing for a second tier network to do. So,
and then they announced that they're looking at doing a new show, which followed Adama as a Viper pilot, so more action oriented.
Yeah.
And I doubt I'll watch, you know, unless they get someone involved like Joss Whedon, which isn't going to happen because he's doing Avengers, but unless they get someone like that that I have a connection with involved, I doubt I'll watch that either.
Hmm.
Just because I got, you know, I already watch too much TV, just full on, so I really need to pick and choose. And it's easier with some of the quicker shows, like you got me into Rubicon. Well, the first season's already over.
Yeah, I love that. I love 13 episode seasons, honestly. I just love that. It's perfect. You get involved for about 2 months and then it's over, and then you get to think a whole year for it coming around, then you get excited again.
Well, the other one was the increasingly poor decisions of Tom Margaret. Yeah.
That's 6 episodes.
Is it 6?
I think it's 6, maybe 8.
Actually, you know what? I think it might be 13.
Oh, really?
Because they start each show with him getting, he's in a British courtroom getting yelled at as they scream things at him like money laundering, child.
Dang. Child and I don't know. That was a hell of a yell.
That was a happy yell.
Oh, okay.
Nancy's up there with it. And screaming all these things at him. And then each show, it says, you know, 10 days earlier. And then the next show, it'll say 9 days earlier. So the show is leading up to him being arrested. And I think it started out as 13 days earlier. Okay. So anyway, it's
Speaking of David Cross, I noticed on Netflix they had a special by him that I had not heard of before called Bad and Batterer. And it's pretty funny. It's weird how David Cross has sort of, he appears to be going through a midlife crisis because he's got this full-on beard and he's like very proud of this entire sleeve of tattoo he's got on his left arm, but still pretty funny and interesting. It was, he filmed in Boston, I think, or Massachusetts somewhere. But anyway, it was like on Netflix, it just showed up. Somehow I had missed this, but it's weird. He's like put on a little weight and he's got this beard and it's almost like he's, something's going on with him or something. I don't know what the story is, but funny special.
But in Todd Margaret, the beard is gone.
Yeah.
And it's the show. I'm most of the way through the latest episode.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because I thought Will Arnett was just going to have a cameo
in
the first episode. And actually, he's been in a few. He's been in a lot of them. And now he's actually in London. He's visiting. And he is hysterical.
Yeah.
I mean, part of it is he's swearing off the hook.
Yeah.
Because it's IFC. And I don't want to. I'll repeat some of them when we're done taping because it's hysterical. But it's actually very funny. And so it's gotten, you know, it's one of those shows that has sort of office-type awkward humor as David Cross's character digs this hole bigger and bigger and bigger. But it's the past couple episodes, it's gotten funnier and less easier for me to watch.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's they changed the tone or I'm used to it now. I'm not sure exactly what's going on, but I definitely like the show.
IFC is the weirdest channel because it's almost a basic cable channel because it's not, you typically don't buy it premium. Sometimes on some systems, it's part of a premium package, but I've noticed like on a bunch of them, no, it's part of a basic cable lineup like AMC, yet you watch it and there's nothing edited like AMC. That Carlos movie, which was so amazing. One thing that was not so amazing was the fact that there was an enormous amount of male frontal nudity. Maybe not an enormous amount, but any amount is an enormous amount for me. And 3 separate times in a movie is a lot. And I was struck by, wow, this is kind of like a basic cable channel. Yet here I am spending minutes of my life staring at a dude's Johnson. And I was surprised by it to a certain extent. I don't know on your system whether it's part of the basic package, but on DirecTV you get it as part of your basic system, whether you have HBO or anything. So anyway, so you're saying how there's like a bunch of swearing on there. That's another thing. A lot of basic cable channels, they pointedly, even though there's no reason to do it, legal reason, they, if they have swearing at all, they put it on like after midnight or 10 o'clock or something. But not AFC. They go for the gusto.
Yeah, it's a definitely a funny show, and we're of course huge David Cross fans. Something else that you just reminded me of that I should have talked about a little earlier was, of course, the Rally to Restore Sanity.
Yes.
So this was Jon Stewart's big thing in DC, as well as there were some unconnected. Satellite rallies, and we actually went to the Seattle unconnected satellite rally yesterday morning.
Yep.
Not bad. It was fairly well organized, and their setup was interesting. They had a big jumbotron there, and they connected to the DC feed, but they didn't really tell you. They kind of had a schedule up on the website of when they expected to connect, but they said, you know, the DC people aren't really giving us much.
Yeah.
And besides, you know, we have local stuff too. You don't just want to show up here and stand outside for 3 hours to watch a big TV.
Yeah.
And so I thought, you know, that's a pretty good idea. They're mixing it up with the local and the national, and they're doing this. And so I thought it was fairly well organized. They had some local comedians. They had a DJ, which was a good idea because anytime there was downtime, and you could tell there were a few instances where, like, oh, we didn't think we would have downtime now.
Yeah.
We'll get the DJ playing some music. And it actually worked out very well. Huh. You know, the crowd was, I think, in a pretty good mood. There were some funny signs. The best sign, the absolute best sign, I took like 4 pictures of it, was, that's just like your opinion, man. With a picture of the dude.
Did you see that? I sent you some guy opened a Lebowski store.
Yes, I saw
my
that.
My God.
That
is- and you read the article, you or look at it, you realize you get the feeling the store is open maybe every third day when he feels like it. So it was like, I can't believe this. This stupid thing has been going on for 15 years now. It's just like your opinion, man. So how many people do you figure were there?
Hard to tell. They were expecting between 5,000 and 6,000.
Did it feel like that?
It was a lot. We were sort of towards the front off to the side. Mm-hmm. And Westlake Park tapers back pretty far.
Yeah.
So it felt full.
Yep.
I don't know if it had 5,000 or 6,000 people, but it felt full. And we lasted about 2 hours and 15 minutes before, our almost 2-year-old, was fully into wiggle pants mode and would not be up on the shoulders anymore. And if you put him on the ground, he would not be content to just sit there in your 1 square foot of cubic,
yeah.
1 square foot of space. So that's how long we lasted. And of course we taped the DC one and came home and watched it over the course of the rest of the day.
Yeah.
And found out that actually the, being at the local one was good because what they chose to not show were all of the musical performances.
Yeah, some were great, but for the most part horrible. Not what I was interested in seeing.
Yeah, exactly. You know, if you're seeing a
One in particular was massively horrible. That was Kid Rock and Sheryl Crow, and Kid Rock doing a song that was possibly the stupidest song. I'm sure he thinks it means something, but it was the stupidest message. The message was, hey, you can't change anything. You can't change world hunger. You can't change the homeless person you're seeing on the street. You can't change people suffering here, but the least you can do is care. That's the least you can do. And it's like, yeah, that is the least you can do. But actually, you can change homelessness. You can change this stupid. It was the dumbest message. And somehow Kid Rock has morphed into this middling ballady singer. It's like, what happened to Kid Rock of Bada Bida, the whole rapper, white boy Detroit rapper from the mid-90s? It's weird how he's become this totally different guy. But honestly, the whole Yusuf Islam, Ozzy Osbourne, OJ's thing, I thought was awesome.
I thought so as well. And just like, how did they talk Cat Stevens into that? How did they talk Ozzy Osbourne into
that? It was amazing. It was perfectly well done, because you got excited and then they cut it off and then somebody else came on and it was like, oh my God, Cat Stevens, his voice sound, it was weird for a second there. It sounded like a record. His voice hasn't changed a bit. Ozzy's was a little iffy, and even the OJ's was a little iffy, but the way it worked out was perfect. I was like, I had chills down my spine. I thought that was terrific. And at the beginning, the Roots played for like 40 minutes and you weren't sure. You're going, what is this? And then you realize later, oh, I guess the rally actually starts at 10, not 9. So they basically brought them out and then the Mythbusters out, and the Mythbusters was boring as hell, but my God, it was exciting to see. Oh my God, it's the Mythbusters. It's like, there's this confluence between two things that I love, the Daily Show thing and the Mythbusters thing. And somebody has brought those two subsets together, or two sets to make a subset. And I was like, I'm in that subset. This is wonderful. I'm excited. So, yeah, so it was, and of course there was other subsets too. Mick Foley was there. You know, Ozzy Osbourne. It was like, wow, all these things I love from totally different realms have converged into this thing. So,
well, my read on it was overall sort of the same for both Seattle and the DC one. They were both well executed given the amount of time they had.
Yeah.
However, had they been planning it for like a year, or had they had an extra couple of months, I think they really could have nailed it.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I totally thought it didn't totally come off, and that made for me made it kind of feel almost better in a sense. It just was sort of, it felt like it felt. It didn't feel like it was this perfectly executed show. You know, they would cut to like the correspondence in the crowd, never worked, kind of trying to shoehorn them in. And then other things just worked really well. His final speech was a little odd because it was like all of a sudden it's a rally, but then it just felt perfect. And, you know, all these different things, I don't know. It just, the overall effect to me was incredibly positive to me, and part of it was the fact that it didn't totally come off perfectly. So I don't know. It's hard to say, but I thought it was kind of fantastic. And it's funny how they spent all of their time downplaying or grossly inflating the numbers of people were there. Yeah. Because I saw a picture of it, like somebody somewhere, I'll have to find it and send it to you, but they showed a picture of the Beck rally and a picture of this rally. It had to be five times the number of people as the Beck rally. Now, I haven't seen numbers, actual numbers. I saw two different sites say it was about 250,000 people, but regardless, it clearly was four or five times bigger than the Beck rally.
And there were some, Huffington Post had some 200,000 estimates.
Yeah.
There were a couple of posts on Talking Points Memo from people that were there saying, you know, the crowd was clearly more than they planned for.
Yeah.
They did not have enough Jumbotrons going back. They did not have enough speakers. People were basically giving up and going to local bars to watch it there.
Yeah.
And so that's sort of, and granted, you're doing something like this, which is really vaguely defined. And that was sort of the point. That was the whole shtick about the thing is, do you have time to go to a rally? We really don't want you.
Yeah.
So and you get it, and you understand that they really had no idea, you know, who's going to show up for a silly thing. Well, it turns out a ton of people.
Yeah, the only thing I would have done differently in how they covered it, which I thought was well shot, was they needed to have rented a helicopter and shown a shot, because when the Mythbusters were doing the wave and it would go back, and then it would go back, and then after a while you realize, oh wait, it's still going. In fact, it's only about halfway to the back, because it was so far back that you kind of didn't, I kind of wasn't getting the fact that there was masses of people back there, and the telephotoing compressed everybody. And then you realize, wow, this is, it's like a quarter mile deep or longer. I mean, this is just a massive amount of people back there. Just is amazing. So I loved it. I thought it was terrific. And all the really horrible parts, like the PK Winsome part and other stuff, it just sort of moved along in my brain. You know, I thought it was awesome. And I loved the fact that they gave out those awards for Sanity. I thought they were terrific. Yeah. I love that the first time I've ever seen that guy interviewed, they brought that crazy airline attendant on to apologize. And that numbskull from the Real Housewives of New Jersey. I mean, it was funny. It was clever. I would just, I loved it.
I thought their fear award to NPR was great.
Gave it to a seven-year-old. Oh no, that was the media. Okay. Girl. The seven-year-old girl was hilarious.
Yeah, that was hysterical.
That said, I completely concur with NPR and media. The simple fact is, despite their efforts to call this thing nonpartisan, the fact is, if I am hearing that, because they weren't talking about covering it, they're talking about people attending this rally. And if you were hearing that somebody from Fox News is, although they don't ban them, but if you heard that somebody from Fox News on their weekend was going to several Sarah Palin rallies, don't you find that troubling journalistically? And
well, of course, but that's never stopped them.
Well, I'm saying that. So what NPR, what these other outlets were doing, were saying, we have a higher standard. We have what we would call a journalistic standard. And political rallies, you are effectively a representative of our organization. So you going there is going to, is going to make people question your journalistic integrity. So you cannot go, whether it's Democrat, Republican, conservative, or liberal. And that's what they said. So while it may not stop Fox News, should it be up to NPR to lower themselves to Fox News' standards or raise them to it? To maintain a stand. So I agreed with it. But I also thought it was extremely funny how they made fun of them. So I got the best of both worlds, I guess.
There you go. I'm trying to think. I guess there really isn't anything else to say about the rally to restore sanity.
Yeah. And I had it on TiVo, so it was kind of perfect because I was like, I was busy all morning and there I was being able to fast forward. So it was a 3-hour rally and I saw it in about 2 hours and I thought that was about perfect.
Oh, and speaking of NPR, I've been wanting to bitch about this for a couple of weeks.
What's that?
The NPR iPhone app. The way it's designed, I think, is really, it works, for the most part, really, really well. It just crashes about 80% of the time. Huh. It's so frustrating because, they had local stations have their pledge drive a couple of weeks ago, which is just, Patton Oswalt has this fantastic routine about NPR being unlistenable. It's incredibly great. It's, it's really valuable to have, but it's unlistenable. And he's got this whole routine about Chilean scream singers, and it's hysterical. but listening to NPR during Pledge Week is just stick a gun in your mouth unlistenable. I've got this app, and you go and you... What you do is you can look it up by program. So there's All Things Considered or Morning Edition. Boom. You click on the thing and then it gives you a list of all of the current stories. And you say, I'm going to add the story about John Boehner to the playlist. I'm going to add the story about Dallas Cowboys to my playlist. I'm going to add the story about Google buying the windmill power conduit.
Yeah,
thing.
You get to be like your own little program director. You can pick what's going on.
Here's the 10-minute story about a Brazilian musical artist that I am absolutely positively not going
the
to
scream
listen
singers.
To. Exactly. And so you put all the stuff in your playlist, and then you listen to your playlist, and it's brilliant.
Yeah.
Except for either you go to the program, and it won't load the stories from the current day, or you get your playlist all set up, and then you tap on one to play, and it crashes the app.
Yeah.
Which, honest to God, happens. I am not being hyperbolic. At least 50% of the time, one of those things happens to me. 50%. I am not exaggerating. I am not doing that for effect. Literally, half the time, I try and use this stupid app, which I want to work so badly, it crashes on me and I get pissed.
I've noticed apps like this that store your lists of preferences have a habit of crashing. My New York Times app does that all the time as well. And the thing that the NPR thing that I don't like is that I save my list, but I don't know, maybe there's a setting there, but for whatever reason, every time I turn on, I try to delete the things on my old list, but they're still there. So every time I turn it on, it's like 29 items on my list, and it's things that I put on like 5 months ago. And I'm like, no, just make it easier. I love how they do it as well. And I've had a similar issue with crashing as well. And it's funny because they pointedly put out their first app, which was okay. And then they utterly redesigned it. And reading their explanation for the redesign, is clear they put a lot of people in charge of this project. So they're pretty proud of it. And I just wonder if they're getting, you know, if they're getting the feedback about the app crashing. That said, have you tried, you know, fully deleting it and then reinstalling it?
I have not.
Because I know with my New York Times app, that was the only thing that worked. Fully deleting the thing, doing a hard reset of my computer so it's iPhone so it's totally flushed, and then reinstalling it. But who knows? You know, it's likely that won't make any difference, but you never know.
Yeah, it's just one of those things that, God, I want it to work so bad. And it just doesn't.
Yeah, I'm starting to realize how much of my day used to be taken up with watching either Netflix or more particularly Slingbox. And now, you know, I'm at work and you can't watch TV. And even if I wanted to, there's no 3G. So suddenly I'm finding myself listening to a lot more NPR lately, which is good. I vacillate between NPR, Howard Stern, and heavy metal music, whichever I need. Do I need to be perked up? Do I need to zone? You know, what do I need? So
that's funny. I don't really have too much else to talk about.
Yeah.
There was an article I forwarded you about a week ago about someone I'd never heard of, but basically it was a review of Google TV. And I thought it was a really interesting walkthrough. And the takeaway was the setup is such a pain in the butt that even high-tech nerds like you and I would have trouble with it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought, you know, I understand you want to, you know, your first version of a product is often not perfect. And that's the case for just about any company that makes a product. And there's some, I think, forgiveness, you know, acceptance and forgiveness of that fact. But Google has this philosophy, whether, you know, the conventional thinking seems to be that it's because they're all engineers there and they just don't think about the users that much. At this point, they've been around long enough that I really kind of think that's a straw man argument. But
yeah,
kid starts wailing upstairs. But you just have to wonder, it's like, how many times are they going to get that criticism and then not do anything about it? And I'm reading this article about everything you have to go through to set up Google TV, and I think, oh my God, that's not just something my dad couldn't do. That sounds like something that's three generations from my dad being able to do.
Yeah, and even if you could, as they pointed out, the experience left an enormous amount to be desired. It felt like a beta version of this. So they were describing, for instance, I mean, one of the big selling points to this is you can like check out Twitter feeds or read Facebook feeds while you're watching TV, which would be great. Okay, so you just presume that, okay, I'll put the TV in this corner, I'll make it the size I want, I'll put the Twitter feed over here, make it the size I want. No, apparently it just squeezes the TV down to this small little postage stamp on the right and has this giant Twitter feed on the left, which is great if that's exactly what you want. Probably most people don't want it that way, but there's no option to change it. And it's likely that would be changed in future versions of this. What's crazy is that they didn't give you that option, or they released this thing where that's the only option, because that struck me as an absolute no-brainer that you shouldn't do it this way. Shouldn't presume that when you're pitching something as TV, that the actual TV portion, when you're doing it using the functionality thing, is a postage stamp, you know, image. It looks like a picture-in-picture TV kind of thing.
Yeah, totally agree.
So
it's just, yeah, and it's like, how do you, even as an engineer, how do you look at that and think, oh yeah, no one's going to want to have the TV portion bigger.
I equated it with the whole, you know, the release of that Google phone they sold a year and a half ago and then stopped selling because they started to realize, oh my God, we don't know how to deal with customer service. If somebody is upset, the, you know, it turns out when somebody, they couldn't get their phone working, you had to email Google. Then they would get back to you within like a few days, which is how Google works with everything, but not how when somebody buys a new phone, they want to address their concerns. And they finally solved it by getting out of these phone selling business. And I'm thinking, this is similarly thought out. Google is not a hardware business. It should not be trying to do this. And maybe it will get better. But I was just struck by how when Apple releases something, it may not be perfect, but it sure seems perfect at the time. And it sure seems to work extremely well, like the user experience. And Google seems to have the exact opposite philosophy. So,
well, it's just this, you know, they've been knocked forever for this perpetual beta.
Yeah.
You know, Gmail being in beta forever, all of their products being in beta forever, which, you know, gives them the, you know, they can always throw up their hands and say, don't blame us, it's in beta. You're the one using it while it's in beta form, ha 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 ha, which is just so, just ridiculous. And,
yeah.
You know, sort of, so in there's that vein, but there's just, I don't even have the words. How do you do this as a company continuously? You know, your first year or two, and you don't, you know, you're getting, oh, we're a company now. We need to figure this out. You know, how do you release the phone, like you said, without someone realizing, oh, gosh, we need to support a product? I think they're
so big that they're not learning lessons from this stuff. So if they were having to, like, bet the farm on this product, it would be more thought out, but I think that they're so big that they can keep sort of applying their standard thought about it, about how we release software, and not realize that that lesson isn't learning here. This isn't going to cost them hardly anything. See, that's the irony about this. It's Google TV, it's branded, but really they're just delivering software. The people that are going to take the big hit, if there is a hit, is manufacturers that are ramping up production of this stuff. But even there, they're not going to take a huge hit. I mean, it's just, it's sort of riskless, and they're not learning any lessons from it. Apple, because they're putting out the hardware themselves, it's a much riskier proposition for them. And therefore, I think they spend the energy to get it totally right. But I don't know, who knows where it will be, but it just strikes me as, when I was listening to a lot of the coverage, I was struck by, this sounds like clearly a pretty half-baked piece of crap product, yet it's getting tons of coverage from mainstream press that who have no idea what it is, but they're just excited about these two words being put together in the same sentence,
yeah.
Google and TV. So I'll listen to different news shows, and they'll talk about this. They don't even know what it is. They certainly aren't reviewing it. They're just describing it because they like those two words. Well, you know what? There's going to become a point when the word Google will represent in mainstream press the idea of half-baked products. And they're really at risk of doing that. Right now, it means coolest thing in the world. We love it every day. And oh, TV, we love that. But pretty soon, it will be different. That's why Apple, you know, was so aggressive about trying to damp down and deal with the antenna issues, because the last thing Apple wants to be is, when people think of them, is not the coolest thing in the world, but coolest thing that constantly has little problems that are ruining the experience. They don't want that. And Google doesn't seem to realize they're in a similar position.
Yeah, it's really quite, I don't know, it's quite stunning. And you know, you're talking about the end product. But even when you get beyond all the setup for Google TV, then when you take your Google TV and you go to NBC.com and it's blocked, and yeah. Everything, well, not everything, all like all the network sites but Fox are blocked, and Fox was thinking about it.
Yeah.
Just stunning that, you know, that I would be super pissed if I had paid money for a Google TV and I go through all the drama of getting it set up, and then these sites are blocked.
Yeah, there's literally nothing on there. It's like nothing. Although ironically, if you have that Play On server that I have, where you know, stream stuff from your computer to your Xbox, where they've now got a component so it works with Google TV. So almost all the things that are blocked, you can get now through the Play On server. But that, but the fact that it's going through Google TV is almost an afterthought. You can get it through your Xbox. You can get it through anything that can put stuff on your TV. So I can watch Hulu on my TV through my Play On server. I can watch Comedy Central and PBS and NBC and ABC and all those because the Play On server does it. But that has nothing to do with Google TV at all. So anyway. And the reason it works there is because they're willing to kind of circumvent the rules in a way that Google TV has pointedly decided we're not going to. We could easily come up with a workaround to allow Hulu TV to play on here, but we don't want to piss them off, so we're not going to do it.
Yeah, so. And it's just, you know, the content companies are really going to have to get it together. There is a fine line between having a Mac Mini hooked up to my TV and using that to go to Hulu and a Google TV.
Exactly.
I understand their fear, but you have got to figure it out and deal with it.
Yeah, when you have a monitor, a 32 or a 40-inch monitor for your Mac Mini, and you have a 32-inch TV, what is the appreciable difference? You know, there is no difference, but there's all these very clear differences in the minds of these content producers. So
yeah, it's wacky. And actually, I did think of one other thing we could talk about before we hang up.
Sure.
I forwarded you. I wasn't even a forwarded story. It was just a little blurb at work that I saw. Oh, hey, look, there's a rumor that Apple might buy Sony. That was one of those instances where you come back with like the five paragraphs of thoughtful response with data and this and anecdotes and that. And it wasn't that, and it was very consistent with Richard sends Matt a link. Matt responds with okay or yeah or oh that's too bad or uh huh. Matt sends Richard a link, and Richard writes back with a 4-page response.
It's hard for me not to. I think in paragraphs.
Anyway, so I sent you this link that, oh, Apple might buy Sony. It's a rumor. And you're like, well, that's the stupidest thing in the history of the universe, and here's why. And I was like, dude, I was just saying it was interesting. I wasn't even advocating it.
But it is interesting, but I can't imagine it possibly happening.
They mentioned it on MacBreak Weekly, which is why I bring it up now. And they're saying, and one of them said, well, that's just stupid. There's no reason to do that. I think Alex said, well, now, wait a second. I think if it's a valid rumor, if they were to do this, I think it's just because of the content, all of the artists that Sony has signed musically and the movies and TV. He says, if Apple were to do this, I don't think they would care so much about the products. They want the content.
Well, see, that would be the most amazing thing ever, that Sony's only value, Sony, one of the greatest manufacturing electronics companies in the history of the planet, their only value is their content from their movie studio.
But and that would be enough of a potential value that it would overshadow the products.
But what do they deal with the products? Because the products, it would be sorry, go ahead.
And on MacBreak Weekly, they had a big discussion about that between Alex and Andy and Leo about, well, what do? You just slap an Apple logo on everything, like all the TVs and the PS3 and one of them said yes, and that's no way, but it's like, no, it's like Apple doesn't put its logo on something unless it's been through the product development ringer at Apple. And so you're entirely right. From a product sense, it makes almost no sense.
My suspicion, if it ever even remotely happened, literally Sony would be an entirely separate entity. And it would be, and then they would take the content stuff and work out a way for that to be there. And then they would pick and choose some very specific things to morph over into an Apple thing. But everything else would be entirely separate, because that last thing, like I was sending you, I don't think people have an idea of how extensive the product line is from Sony. If you ever get like one of those specialty B&H catalogs that's literally thicker than a phone book for high-end electronic gear, 30% of it is Sony. It's stuff nobody has ever heard of, yet they have hundreds of items in there. Right. Sony makes like 17,000 items. Apple makes like 17 items.
Yeah,
and Sony makes less money on those 17,000 items than Apple does on their 17. I mean, the nightmare that would, you know, if I was Sony and I could afford to buy Apple, I could go, yeah, I could get this. If I was Apple, the idea of owning a manufacturer of 17,000 items is terrifying.
Well, from a product perspective, it doesn't make sense. But from a content perspective, and their other point was, from a content perspective, suddenly Apple essentially is controlling Disney content and Sony content. That really, really puts the boot on the neck of the other content providers to say, you play with us or you're going to get left behind.
Yeah.
That brings up a whole other question of, would Department of Justice even allow that? Because suddenly, you know, you get back into the, channel, the person who owns the channel owns the content. Well, Comcast is trying to buy NBC. So you get into, well, would it pass the Department of Justice stuff, which is an interesting discussion, but I don't know. It just brings to mind the fact that when you have $40 billion in cash or whatever it is,
yep,
the number of things you can actually do is astounding.
I know. The other rumor, the much, much more serious rumor was the Adobe rumor. And as they point out, Apple could easily, whether Adobe liked it or not, Apple could easily buy Adobe and it wouldn't even remotely affect their bottom line. They've got so much cash that they could just open up their bank account and buy it and it would hardly dent their bottom line. In fact, the profits that, or the increased amount of cash on hand that they made last year alone would have purchased Adobe twice. I mean, that's how much it took them 6 months' time to bring up enough cash to purchase one of the biggest software companies on the planet Earth.
Well, and
I'm sorry, go ahead.
And just sort of in that vein, thinking about Apple, and this is something that Gruber linked to, my new best friend Gruber.
Yeah.
Was he found some stat somewhere like 30% of Apple's revenues are coming from products that didn't exist 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And that really for me is stunning.
Yeah.
That is oh my God. It's not just that the Mac is successful, it's that the iPad is astoundingly successful. The iPhone 4 is astoundingly successful.
Well, and what makes that statistic amazing is that's a part and parcel of that is the fact that the Mac is doing as better than it ever has before.
Exactly.
Here's what I read the other day that Apple now, this is something nobody's talking about. Apple computer, the Macintosh, in the consumer market, not business market, but in the consumer market, has gotten up to 20% market share of new computers sold. 20%, 1 out of 5 new computers sold to an individual, a student, a homemaker, my dad, whatever, is now an Apple computer. 10 years ago, that was 2%.
And part of it sounds like, and again, this is from Mac Break Weekly, it sounds like a lot of that is legitimately coming from the halo effect.
Yeah.
Of PC people buying an iPhone and really enjoying the experience and saying, oh, you know what? I am going to take a look at a Mac the next time it's time to buy a computer.
And I can run Windows on it if I need to. And it's just, that's why I like it. Every once in a while you'll hear that, oh, Apple's really de-emphasizing the computer. But then they'll actually put out some amazing stuff and you realize, no, they're not doing that. They recognize what a great core business it is. And they haven't seemed to have slacked off on it.
It's just, God, it's just astounding. And it's really interesting to watch and compare Apple to Microsoft. And, Microsoft released its earnings and it made like another $15 billion, another $5 billion in profit.
I know. It's because they eliminated your job. They were able to realize these massive savings.
But it's funny because all of that revenue is Windows and Office.
Yeah.
Now they did. And another, it was a Gruber thing. He points out, they made like $500 million, I think, or was it $350 million from Xbox. And it's like, they threw that number in there to sort of say, hey, look, it's not just Windows and Office. But when you compare $350 million to $5 billion or whatever, $15 billion, between revenues versus profits, it's a drop in the bucket.
It's funny how much Xbox occupies my headspace in terms of Microsoft and how it is it was 90% responsible for the positive feelings I have towards Microsoft. Yet it is really a tertiary business of Microsoft. Despite their efforts, it just doesn't, it's not the big thing that they do. Yet in my headspace, that is absolutely number one, the biggest thing that they do. Yet it just isn't, sort of. I don't know.
Well, and you know, I think their long game was, as we've discussed many times in the past, get Microsoft in the living room.
Yeah.
And I think it's working. I think the Xbox is, I think it's going a lot slower than they wanted, and slower than even you and I would want in terms of it being able to view TV through your Xbox. You know, once you get more of an IPTV solution, which they're doing in Europe, and which you can now do through AT&T UVerse, you know, the 10 people that have that.
Yeah.
So I think once you can get TV through the Xbox, it becomes much more of a Microsoft-owned experience, but you can't do that yet.
Yeah.
So I think they're still moving in the right direction, and I still really like my Xbox. I really enjoy it, and if there was an easy way to get TV through it, I would do it, but...
Yeah, it was weird. I was thinking how it still feels totally relevant, current. They have a new update coming in a couple of days. But I was realizing, my God, my Xbox is it 4 years old and yours is like 5? Or is it 3 and 4? Because I got mine in November of, I think 4 years ago. And I was struck by... wow, this is really, I mean, this was the point that they came up, they got rid of Xbox One and came up with the Xbox 360. And I don't think there's any new one on the horizon. So it's kind of interesting that it's, and it still feels totally great. I don't feel like I have a slow, weak system. But they've been around for quite some time at this point. Because I got mine like a full year after you got yours.
They have done a very, very good job of implementation and really... having a much longer life cycle and making it seem like it's not just using something old. You know, the games that come out today still look, you know, look like they're running on a new platform. They look amazing. They're really leveraging. Anyway, they're doing a good job with it, and it'll be, I hope they continue to do a good job with it. Cause it really seems like the one area of the company where they're doing anything interesting at all.
Are you thinking about getting the Kinect?
Yeah, but not immediately.
Yeah. I'm thinking about it too. I honestly was so intrigued by the dance game and the exercise one that but you know, who knows, maybe it's a toy, but I just thought it didn't seem that horribly priced, so I'm definitely thinking about it.
I'll probably get a bundle after the holidays, but we'll see.
Cool.
So we should wrap it up.
Yep.
My name's Matt.
My name is Ricardo Montalban.
And we thank you.